That's how you transmit orthodoxy. And here are their propositions that were in the creed. Through the fall, free will has been so weakened that without prevenient grace or grace that comes before, no one can love God, believe on Him, or do good for God's sake as he ought. That's one of their propositions. So they believed there was free will, but it was a weak will, and it needed God's grace to help it act. Through the grace of God all made, by the cooperation of God, perform what is necessary for their soul salvation. So they could proceed from their decision. Remember, I talked about one aspect, or an analogy was the idea, if you're sick, you can call for a doctor, and you can listen to the doctor, and you need to decide to accept it or not. And that was sort of that was basically the way they would view this. It is by no means our faith that having any have been predestinated by God to sin, but rather if there are people who believe so vile a thing, we condemn them with utter abhorrence. In every good work, the beginning proceeds not from us, but God inspires in us faith and love to Him without merit, pressing on our part so that we desire baptism. And after baptism, can with Himself fulfill His will. So they viewed God having some influence on the what do they do with this will. They couldn't act on it all by themselves, but they still had a choice of accepting or not accepting. You'll see, I make a statement here, Pope Gregory the Great, you can put quotations in the Pope. He wasn't, there wasn't a Pope in the Catholic Church until after Gregory. But in any event, he declared what I just read to be the true Augustinianism. And even though, you remember what Augustine taught, it wasn't what we just talked about. But he said this is truly what Augustine meant by what he said. And so he basically rewrote history in this case and said this is what should be in play for the Catholic Church. And so they had a grace that was prevenient, it had to have an impact of grace, but there was no predestination in this theology. And Gregory had a great impact on what the medieval church would look like and how it would develop. You'll see that as we go through. There were still the strict people that followed strict Augustine doctrine. They didn't want to let it go. You may know this name, Bede, you may have heard that name. He was one of them. You may have heard of Wycliffe and Huss. These were people who had come along prior to the Reformation. They were strong adherents to the Augustine views, contrary to the Catholic Church at that time. And, of course, Calvin would basically take Augustine, recast it, and get it performed, studied here not too long ago. I want you to know the couple of items on here I listed, A and B under 3, last two sections in this lesson. The primary concern of both these groups was to keep man's will free. We've seen that. But the question is, why? And one of the reasons was that they would be dependent upon the Catholic Church. They had a choice. And the Catholic Church wanted them to have a choice. And, of course, the second piece of that, if there was irresistible grace, and if there was predestination, and if there were elect, then why do you need the Catholic Church? Why do you need that organization? It's not unlike Calvinism. If people today are predestined to be saved, why bother to preach the gospel? And this is similar to that kind of thing. And so this is why I think in large part that the theology that would be accepted by the Catholic Church turned out to be like it was.
So when you say they want to be taught and they want to keep man's will free, that's from a, I guess, a limited atonement perspective?
It's from the standpoint of they did not want a person to be totally depraved and therefore couldn't do anything.
Gotcha. So they have it.
And the baptism.
And then, excuse me, I'll come back to that. Of course, you know, we've seen there were people that, like Pelagius, that believed this. I mean, it wasn't convenient. He believed it. But it would be, excuse me, there may have been others that believed it, but it was very convenient that it fit the need of the organization element.
Okay, you know, the D part of your B there, it says it is in baptism that our will is renewed. Is that baptism into the Catholic Church? Remember you discussed that on page 62, you know, it is in baptism that our will is renewed. Is that connected to the Catholic Church?
It's connected to yes, it is. It's connected to theology. Synod.
Right. I mean, it's got nothing to do with the new birth that we have in Christ now. I mean, it's totally different, and this was...
At this time, when you're baptized, I think the way to do it is when you're baptized, you now... God has strengthened your will. Yeah. It's probably the best way to describe it.
Power.
And now you can do good.
Yeah.
And remember, works are going to be important. You have to be able to do good. Works are going to get important. It was going to get to be important as we go forward.
Well, so we've been talking a lot about Augustine. I think you made the comment, correct me if I'm mistaken. You said that Augustine was probably one of the most influential men during this time period. And thinking back, why was it so influential? You mentioned his extensive writing. There's the political thing about trying to keep the emperor in power. Was he kind of latching on up? So in a nutshell, how would you, when you look back at Augustine, why was he so influential?
Because of his theology. Because of what he brought to the party was, for the Catholic Church, the basic doctrine of the Trinity. He put that in terms they could live with, if you like, or could get behind, how you want to describe it. His theology with respect to the inherited sin and the need, therefore, to be baptized for that to rid yourself of that inherited sin. And all the other writings he had in terms of the theology that stood behind that, they just didn't have an agree with everything in this case. But he significantly changed, provided the basis for what would happen. Remember, he was in three, four hundreds. And we're talking about Constantine being 300, 350. So these guys are kind of contemporaries, Augustine a little later. And they're both having an impact on how does this religious body develop over time. The other thing I would say is because his teachings across the board would be what Calvin and others would incorporate as being the Word of God, be truth. And so you have a whole, a denominational, you're talking about family trees, religious history, family trees, a whole denominational branch goes off as a result of that. Okay? Any other? Okay, lesson 10. When I introduced the class, talked about the class in general, I made the point at the time that this would not be a chronological class in the normal sense of the word, but we would be covering the same periods of time, looking at it from different directions. And this is, you know, again, we're talking about this what I call the apostate church or the Catholic church, and its doctrine. And you insist we're going to go back, you know, we're talking about Constantine, and, you know, same things that same period of time we've covered, just a little different perspective. The introduction here is really just giving an overview of what we're going to be covering in these next two lessons. We're really starting to see, I will be covering, the Western Church, not the Eastern. The Eastern Church was pretty much dominated by politics, and it didn't have a lot of doctrinal significance. That was not true in the Western Church. The Western Church, generally speaking, during this period, was active from a missionary standpoint, converting the Germanic tribes. There was war throughout this period, and so you had the Germanic tribes coming down from the north that would be impacting on the empire. We'll talk about some of that as we go through this. Just a number of geopolitical changes that were going on throughout this whole period. The so-called Dark Ages, you had these tribes that were involved in war, etc. And you had the church. We'll see where the church stepped in to fill a vacuum that existed because of that, because of their influence. The church also, during this period of time, would become very wealthy and at the same time very worldly. So we'll speak to that some as we go through here. There are a number of doctrines that get developed in this Middle Ages period. The ones that I'll just describe to you or mention to you, purgatory would come into being in 593, prayer to Mary, the saints and angels 10 years later, kissing the Pope's foot, 709. I don't know if that's does anybody know if that's even practiced now? Kissing the ring's practice. I don't know if kissing the foot is.
Surely would if he let him.
Yeah. Probably so. Making the canonization of dead saints came on about 1000 A.D. Celibacy and priests, 1079. Rosary in 1090. Transubstantiation, confessing sins to a priest in 1215. And the seven sacraments in 1400. So you see there's a number of doctrines that got established and became Catholic theology during this period of time, or Catholic practice during this period of time, that are still true today. I'm not sure about the Pope's foot, but the rest of these are. We talked about a number of controversies during this period, like iconoclastic controversy, the filioque controversy. Scholasticism came into play. You all heard, I assume most of you have heard the name Thomas Aquinas. He was one of those who was a scholar, and he tried to deal with doctrine from a rational standpoint. And then we had some of the things we talked about with respect to moving away from pure Augustinian views that came upon the church. I don't want to make, the intent of this class, this lesson, is not to make us great students of the Roman Empire history. Really, the intent is to show the importance of what was going on in environmental and geopolitical issues going on in terms of how the church, the Roman Catholic Church, was influenced and got integrated. Some of the things that were going on, the peoples involved, got integrated into the church and impacted on its development and its teachings. And as these geopolitical activities are going on, the church is in the middle of it. So they have a role to play, or they exerted themselves. Between the first century and, I guess, the official date of the Roman the fall of Rome was 476, you had a number of Germanic tribes that were involved in attacking the empire, or the territories of the empire. I've listed them here, the Angles, the Saxons, the Vandals, Lombards, Franks, Goths. Attila the Hun was involved in some of this. The exact reason why why Rome fell is probably internal decay, but thought about in terms of an event with the Germanic tribes that would come down and attack Rome and eventually cause it to fall in 476. The Visigoths, and we'll talk about a few of these people, the Visigoths were one of the groups, and by the way, there's some maps at the end of this lesson that you can look at and get a sense of who these people were, or not who they were, but where they were coming from. That's just for your reference. The Visigoths came in, and as they would attack, they would take prisoners, and the prisoners, some of the prisoners would be Christians, and they would actually spread Christianity to those attackers. And so the Visigoths ended up being introduced to Arian, the Arian wing. The God of Jesus is a created being. That's what Arius taught. And this is what they were taught, because one of the first people that were made bishops among the group was made bishop by an Arian bishop, or made leader, actually, of that community. He was made that by an Arian bishop. And so they became Arian Christians, quote unquote, and they ended up spreading that form of Christianity to most of the other Germanic tribes. And as you move through time, through this period of time, you had Constantine. You remember how Constantine got to be emperor, all the things that went on with his family. Well, that introduced a period of about 100 years of a relative peace. And then at the end of the 300s, you had the empire being divided between two young sons of Theodosius. There is a king of the Visigoths, a name of Alaric, and he tried to play these two off one another. And Constantinople kind of encouraged that, and in fact, he invaded Italy in 401. And he invaded them, then he made it to Rome by 410, and he sacked Rome. And then he left. And so the sacking of Rome was not a big, it was a big deal. But the fact he left, they didn't fall, but it had a terrific psychological impact. Because Rome never had been 800 years before, since anybody had ever attacked and was able to sack Rome. So the people of the empire were pretty well shook up because of that. The Visigoths went on back to Rome, and back to Gaul, and you had the death of Alaric. And in the meantime, you had Attila the Hun comes over and attacks Rome. And by tradition, at least, the quote Pope Leo, who was in place at the time, stopped him, supposedly, kept him from just absolutely destroying the city. And he left, Attila left after that, and he died, and so the Huns didn't come over and do any more attacking. Meantime, you had the Vandals, keeping up all this, you had the Vandals, who also had a king by the name of, Gazeric. And he went over to Spain, came down on the North Atlantic, North African coast, took that over, and then he ended up being a sea power, and he had started attacking Rome from sea. And so you had, you know, you had Rome was starting to get caught in pincers. And they were basically leaderless. And so Leo, quote unquote Leo, also reportedly saved Rome from just total destruction by this guy, even though he was there for 2 weeks sacking the city. He apparently did a lot less damage than he could have. And so for the next 20 years or so, there's various battles going on. If you ever look at interesting is the right word, but if you look at the Roman Empire through this period of time, it's like, you know, there's a different war going on with a different nation every 3-4 years. So it's a constant state of war and change. Eventually, the Roman Empire, Roman army, if you've ever heard, if you've even seen movies, you might have picked up on this. Rome got to the point where they really didn't have enough people that were native to defend themselves. So they ended up having barbarians as their army. And so that army in Italy revolted. The natural citizen army basically disappeared, and they elected a guy, the barbarian army did, by the name of Odoacer. And he ended up taking over as the emperor in the West. And he sent his representatives over to the Eastern Emperor, trying to get an allegiance to the government of Constantinople and to get recognized as the Emperor of the West. And so that's how he got in and is being in place as the emperor. And now you've got a barbarian, quote, barbarian general who is now the leader of the Western Empire. In this same general, probably 100 years, a little less than 100 years after that, you have Gregory the Great, Gregory I, who you may remember we talked about. He's the fellow that actually named Boniface as Pope, Boniface III, I want to say, in 607. He didn't name him, that's who followed him in 607. Gregory the Great was called, today would be called by a pope, but he wasn't at the time. But he is regarded pretty much as the father of the imperial papacy. So he's going to have a big part to play in what evolves in terms of the pope, the lineage of the pope and all that, power of the pope, etc. He was wealthy, like a lot of these people, smart, educated, not necessarily smart, but educated. He originally in his life founded monasteries, so he was an ascetic, and then he ended up being convinced by the Bishop of Rome to become a deacon in Rome, and 6 or 7 years later, they elected him the Bishop of Rome. He was not regarded as a scholar, particularly. Didn't know Bible languages, for example. He wasn't much of a theologian. He didn't have pagan learning, actually. And he was, by somebody's estimate, he was not an original thinker. I don't know what that's worth talking to you, but he was not an original thinker. But what he aspired to temporal power. And so he wanted to be reaching out beyond simply ecclesiastical issues. And so you have the setup when Gregory's in place, and during some of the warring that went on during this period, still going on, the emperor actually departed from Rome and left Rome, whoever that emperor was, escaping from the dead is off the top of my head. When they did, it left Gregory behind. And so he became sort of the head in Rome to take care of things. And he took on the secular sovereignty, and by the time he died, having done this, took over for the vacuum of this lab, he was looked at as the chief bishop of the West. He was looked at as a natural arbiter in the Court of Appeals in ecclesiastical cases, and he could intervene with authority in any kind of serious scandal. So he, although he was the nominally the head of the Catholic Church in Rome, he took on these secular duties. And this is where he started to, where this number started. It had since the time of Constantine, you had a battle going on between emperor and the bishop of Rome, or the bishop of Constantinople. It worked both ways. In terms of Gregory, one of the things he did is he actively pursued the conversion of the tribes in the north. And oftentimes this is done by converting a ruler, and the ruler would convert everybody else by edict. And so you can imagine the nature of the Roman Catholic Church during this period of time, and the people that were in it. Gregory was responsible for a couple of new doctrines. One of them was penance, and the idea of penance that he set in place is basically that you could have your sin forgiven of, and on the basis of repentance. But the definition of that was contrition, confession, and satisfaction. Well, satisfaction included penance, and penance was in proportion to sin. So, what ended up being evolved out of that was a need to pay back something for your sin. And this system, this penance system, would evolve over time, of course, in part lead to the Reformation, as we'll see. There is another thing that was put in place right along with it, and that is purgatory. And so if you fail, you didn't respond with the appropriate penance, you could be told that you will spend whatever period of time in purgatory. So that was an incentive for people to do what the church wanted them to do with respect to their penance. So both penance and purgatory, and penance would turn into selling indulgences. I mean, you pay the priest to forgive your sin, basically. And so that and purgatory would become big problems at the Reformation. We'll see as we get into that lesson. So you have a number of things happen as a result of Gregory, in terms of doctrine, in terms of the involvement, say organization, but it's really what role does the quote Pope unquote have in secular affairs? And he was trying to influence that mightily in his time. Okay.
So you mentioned Gregory is the father of the papacy, and that's around the 600s. Did you say that you were going to get to later on about the conference? Since he was kind of the got Boniface, the first pope. Catholics always say you can trace their right all the way back to Peter. But here you're 600 in the first century. You got to later on show us how that goes.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think it's the next lesson.
Stay tuned.
Okay, I made a statement a moment ago that you had Constantine, or from the time of Constantine, people had, there was this battle going on, sometimes significant, sometimes not less significant, between the emperors and our emperors, and the leaders of the church, primarily either the Roman bishop or the Eastern bishop, following Constantine, he had Theodosius the Great in 392, declaring all heathen sacrifice to be treason. And therefore, Christianity, or in addition, Christianity became a state religion. Under Constantine, it was not made the state religion, it just wasn't, it was supported, and Christians were not persecuted. But officially, Theodosius made it the actual state religion. When Constantine was in power, he moved his seat of government to Byzantium, which then would become Constantinople. So he had his seat of government, Constantinople. Both that leaving during his time, that left a bishop and a lesser governmental officials over in Rome. And so I gave the opportunity to those in Rome, Roman bishops, to gain more power. So you see this starting to build back when Constantine was in power. And then you had all these wars I told you about, and these were all opportunities to have the pope or the bishop of Rome play a part, a bigger part all the time. Interestingly enough, the barbarians who were converted, they were almost exclusively Arian. And so you had, for a period of time, you had the Arian church and the Catholic church. And the barbarians looked at the environment they were in, and they actually really felt inferior to the Romans, in part, at least, because they lacked the culture and learning of the Romans. And that led to gradually bringing them under, from a religious standpoint, under the control of the Roman Church. The Franks themselves accepted a lot of Roman ideas, and they converted other tribes to that view as well. Not only were they culturally, in their view, inferior to the Romans, they definitely were not educated like the Romans. They did not have basically illiterate. And so they managed to, because of their influence, they managed to bring upon a lot of the world at this time, in that area, bring them into a situation where they were illiterate as well. Part of that was just them moving in. Part of them was influence on all this. You remember, they were attacking and making raids, so they destroyed a lot of the organizations that would have provided for the learning. And what happened as a result of that, in spite of that, you had the monasteries where learning, teaching continued, education continued. And so you while the average person couldn't read or write, you had monks who did know how to read and write. And if you've done any study on, I think I mentioned this probably in another class, if you've done any study on how we got the Bible, we owe a lot. It's interesting how God works things out. We owe a lot to these monks because they managed to maintain, through copies, a lot of the much of manuscript evidence that we have that allowed the Bible ultimately to be reproduced like it is today. Now, there's a lot of sources. It's not just monasteries, but monasteries, you've heard of the Latin Vulgate, and there's just the four main manuscripts, as I recall, were all found in monasteries. So they served a purpose. And you have, you know, it's just like us. You have political turmoil. What do people do in this political turmoil?
It's spiritual.
Well, they don't. If they're not, spiritually inclined.
Drink.
You want somebody to tell you what to do. Well, how do you think? I mean, a lot of ways, this is why dictators get able to have power. And so, you know, there's chaos, a bunch of illiterate people, and they're looking for somebody to give them the answers. And this was another way that the Roman bishop was there to fill a need that the people had. And so that provided him a... He provided a stabilizing influence in the society, and he became viewed as a being that had some influence or control over a huge swath of people, be it their religion. And so, just like we've seen in the past, the king, and now you start to have some kings in other countries. Or an emperor would look to a bishop to help them secure their reign. And so the bishops were starting, you know, were able to, Bishop of Rome in particular, was able to continue to build on his strength. And one of the groups, the Lombards, I think they were located sort of, whether all of them thought they were located north. I think they came from the northeast, more or less. But they were managed to get into Gaul or France, and then they were attacking Italy. And so you have, and we do have popes being elected now, Pope Stephen II went up to France, and he anointed this Pepin the Short as king of France. And in return, that king drove out the Lombards and gave the Pope a certain portion of Italy. This is where we get the idea of the Papal States. He gave them territory that would become known as the Papal States. And we'll get into what went on after that in Charlemagne and how that this would eventually evolve into the whole Roman Empire. By the way, the